tie up a couple of loose ends from last week. You remember way a long time ago we talked about Benjamin Keach. He was the second pastor of the old Southwark Church, which is now the Metropolitan Tabernacle. And he wrote a book called The Child Instructor about child rearing, having a good Christian family. Well, he had a lot of chance to put that into practice because he was married twice, and he had, I think, something like 14 children. One of his sons, Elias, was wayward. And Elias went to America to get away from his parents, to get away from God, I guess. But for some reason, while he was there, he decided he was going to pretend that he was a preacher. He'd go around the streets of Philadelphia wearing clerical garb. And they asked him to preach. And he actually preached in churches, and he wasn't even saved. And one Sunday as he was preaching, it hit him what a wicked thing he was doing. And he couldn't finish the sermon. He broke down and cried. And he repented of his sin and turned to Christ. And so he's an example of someone who is saved under his own ministry. He was in Philadelphia about the time of the formation of the Philadelphia Association. The Philadelphia Association is the oldest Baptist association of churches in America. And that association set a pattern. And guess what? We're in the Illinois Association. So our association is modeled after that pattern. Baptist churches are independent, but they're also free to associate with other Baptist churches, and that's what we do in the Illinois Association. And then I went to this slide because I wanted to mention one other thing about John Leland, the preacher in Virginia. He's also noted today for a song that he wrote. And if you write a song that's been around for a couple hundred years and people are still singing it, it's probably pretty good. That song is Morning Trumpet. Do we all know it? Do we want to have the pastor sing that for us right now? Okay. He and Pastor Caleb sang it
a month ago.
So, all right, let's get to the slide we want to be on. Okay, Baptist missionary efforts. All right. Ironically, Baptist missionary movement in America began with two Congregationalist preachers, Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice. In 1812, a Congregationalist mission agency sent both to India, but on separate ships, along with others too. They weren't the only two. Knowing that they would meet William Carey, both wanted to be prepared to defend their views on baptism. And so on board ship, they studied their Greek testaments, and they had books available to them in William Carey's library when they got to India. And after a few months of study, they both asked Carey to baptize them. And it would not have been ethically right for them to continue to take money from the Congregationalists in order to plant Baptist churches. So they knew they would have to resign. But what do? Do they go back to America? How do they raise support? Well, the solution they came up with was that Luther Rice would come back to America and raise support, and then once he had raised support for the missionary team, then he himself would return. He never did, but he had a huge ministry in the United States in forming the first Baptist Missionary Society, and this one united both North and South, was all across what was then, in 1812, the United States. He spent the rest of his life raising money for missions and other Christian causes. And Judson moved on to Burma, where his work was at first quite difficult. It was 7 years before he baptized his first convert. And he went through extreme difficulties, nearly dying. He was imprisoned by the Burmese government, and if it weren't for the tireless efforts of his wife to get him food and other provisions, he would not have survived. He had a translation of the Bible in the Burmese that she hid in his pillow. If they had found it, they would have confiscated it. And then as a result of all the privation she suffered in keeping him alive, she died. But once he started working with the Karens, the Karen tribe, there were thousands of conversions. I taught Burmese in seminary back in my other life in California, and he was a Karen. So he was a convert of a convert of a convert of a convert of Adoniram Judson. Besides translating the Bible into Burmese, he composed a Burmese dictionary and a grammar of the language so that the missionaries that followed could learn the language more quickly and become effective in it. Now, reports reached America that lent credibility to the new missionary movement. We'll talk more about that in a minute. There was opposition in the United States to the idea of sending out foreign missionaries. You know, why can't we support our pastor here? You know, why can't we just keep our money here? Why do we have to send it to missionaries on the foreign field? And there was the anti-mission movement was a significant thing in the early and mid-1800s. And these reports from Burma really helped to quell that. You know, it's one thing to argue on a theological level, and people can go back and forth. What does the Bible say? Well, I think it means this. Well, I think it means that. But when someone says, God isn't going to bless this because this is unscriptural, and then you get all these reports of people being saved, it makes it a little harder to argue. We mentioned before that women need more attention in our histories, and so we're going to give some women more attention. Judson married three times, and they were very large contributors to the ministry in their own right. In fact, all three of them have their own separate entry in the Dictionary of American Biography. His first wife was Anne Haseltine Judson. She wrote a catechism in Burmese. She translated portions of the Bible into Burmese and Thai. Her letters to Luther Rice, when published, greatly benefited the cause of missions. Okay, so he didn't take the time out of what he was doing to write about his ministry, but his wife wrote about it. She sent the letters to Luther Rice, and then Rice published them. Okay, so that's how his ministry impacted missions in the United States. His second wife was Sarah Hall. Her first husband was Dr. John Boardman, who was also a missionary to Burma. And Boardman died, and after Judson's first wife died, then the two of them married. She translated the New Testament into Peguan. And her translation of Pilgrim's Progress into Burmese is still in use today, as I understand. His third wife was Emily Chubbuck Judson. Emily was an accomplished writer. She was already a well-known author and poetess, but she wrote under a pen name, Fanny Forrester, when Judson met her. Judson was introduced to her hoping that she would write a biography of his second wife, which she agreed to do, but in the process of consulting on that, the two of them fell in love, and he realized that he needed somebody to help him raise his little kids who were motherless. And so the two of them married and he took her back to Burma with him. Her biography of Sarah Judson did much to advance a missionary cause. So there were problems. The anti-mission movement, the restoration movement, and Adventism and slavery, these were all challenges to the Baptist work in America. The anti-mission movement used extreme Calvinism as its justification, the kind of Calvinism that would make Calvin blush. By the way, in case you didn't know, Calvin was not a Calvinist. As people have examined his teaching, it's obvious that he did not teach the 5 points of Calvinism. By the way, Jacob Arminius was not an Arminian either. The two of them were much closer to one another than their followers are to one another, okay? Each of them have gone off into an extreme, and Calvin and Arminius were much closer together. But they justified it by this extreme Calvinism that we shouldn't do missions. But it also included some emotional elements too. Can you imagine living on the frontier and some village near you with people you knew, maybe relatives, was massacred? How would you feel about reaching the Indians that massacred somebody you knew and loved? Okay, so there was an element of that in this too. Also, it probably had an element of resentment toward Easterners. The Easterners were better educated and the Easterners wanted to do missions. The people out on the frontier didn't, okay? And they resented the Easterners who had better education. As one man said to another who was educated, God can get along just fine without your education. And then the other replied, yes, that's true. He can also get along without your ignorance. The success of Judson and Carey helped to discredit the anti-mission movement. And the restoration movement was also a part of the anti-mission movement because it did quell missions and because it did teach against sending out missionaries. It started with the desire of Alexander Campbell to unite all denominations and restore primitive Christianity. This is what he professed that he wanted to do. He taught that baptism by immersion is essential for salvation, okay? You got to have faith and all that, but you're not really saved until you're baptized. When I say you got to have faith, well, maybe you don't even really have to have faith, but you got to be baptized, that's for sure. Repent and be baptized, every one of you. And all of his followers have that memorized. The movement fragmented Baptists, particularly in the South. In fact, there were whole associations of churches that went off into this movement. And before I get out of there, that's the Disciples of Christ. Okay, the Christian church, that's what they call themselves. They're Campbellites. And they're splintered into different groups. There's some of them believe that it's unscriptural to have musical instruments in your church services. There's others who believe that it is okay. Anyhow, Adventism. Prophecy became a divisive issue beginning with the ministry of William Miller. Now, Miller was a Seventh-day Baptist. Anybody know what a Seventh-day Baptist is? It's a Baptist who believes that worship should be on Saturday, the seventh day of the week, and not on Sunday. Okay? Now, you can make an argument for that. I don't think it's a very good argument, but you can make an argument for that. How many of you remember Milton College? Does it even exist anymore? No. Okay, how many of you remember Milton College? All right, Milton College was a Seventh-day Baptist college. There were a lot of Seventh-day Baptist churches in Western New York. I know there's one town where the First Baptist Church changed its name to the First Day Baptist Church because they wanted everybody to know they were not Seventh-day Baptists. So Miller was a Seventh-day Baptist, and from his study of scriptures, he calculated that Christ would come back in 1843. And then when that didn't happen, he recalculated and said it was going to be 1844. And then when that happened, he had the good sense to say, you know, I think I've been wrong all along. He got out of the ministry, okay, and just became an ordinary church member, which he well should have. So he admitted his error. However, many of Miller's followers concluded that the Bible, rather than the preacher, was wrong. Okay, he told us out of the Bible that Christ was going to come in 1843, and he didn't come. So it must be the Bible failed. Well, it wasn't the Bible that failed, it was a preacher that failed. So they just stopped going to church altogether. There are others that joined a new movement started by Ellen G. White called the Seventh-day Adventism. Okay? So this is the Baptist contribution to Seventh-day Adventism. And Ellen White had these visions. What can I say? She came from a family of hatters. And hatters, to shape the felt in their hats, use mercury. And long exposures to mercury can cause you to have hallucinations, and many people think that that was what was going on with her, is that she had enough mercury in her system that it caused her to have hallucinations, and that's where her visions came from. Slavery. The issue of slavery came to a head in 1845 when the Northern churches refused to support missionaries who owned slaves. There was a particular case that came up. And this caused an explosion. Up until that point, North and South had been united in what was called, for short, the Triennial Convention. They had a much longer name. It was called the Triennial Convention because the Board of Trustees would meet once every 3 years, and they'd appoint missionaries. Back then, the mission agency raised the money for you. You sent money into the mission agency, and then they distributed it to the missionaries, so the missionaries didn't have to go on deputation or anything like that. That's okay as long as you have good missionaries and as long as somehow you find a way to connect the missionaries to the local churches so that the local churches can feel like they're part of the ministry and can pray for them. But when you have an organization that will send out missionaries that are good and others that are not so good, do you really want your church's money going to something like that? That's why we support faith missions. Baptist World Mission is a faith mission. Gospel Fellowship Association is a faith mission, and so on. We don't send our money into a denomination and then have the denomination decide who they're going to support. We as a church decide who we're going to support. And you can support denominational missionaries that way too, but here's what happens. You send the money in to support your particular missionary, and they say, okay, we're giving this money to your missionary, and then they take the money they would have given to that missionary that you're supporting, and then they give that to some other missionary that you might or might not want to support. So that's why we do faith missions. And this was a big deal, slavery, the slavery issue, and as we all know, it led to war. Like most denominations, the Baptists split between North and South. It wasn't just the Baptists, it was the Presbyterians, it was the Methodists. They all split over the issue of slavery. Baptists in the South organized into a tightly knit convention on the theory that united we stand, divided we fall. So they had a very strong, tight, central organization. But this jeopardized local church autonomy, and I believe it does so to this day, which is one of the reasons why I would not want to be part of the Southern Baptist Convention. There are others too, but that's one of them. Baptists in the North prefer to work through independent missionary, educational, and publishing agencies at the discretion of the local church. But theological liberalism from Europe began infiltrating schools in the North. So the problem in the South was local church autonomy. The problem in the North was the infiltration of theological liberalism. And the liberals did infiltrate in the South, though, but it took longer. In the 19th century, most non-Catholic churches preached the gospel. And the word evangelical comes from the biblical word for gospel. So we call those churches evangelical. So in the 19th century, the word evangelical is good. It just simply means that that church preached the gospel. And that was true of most churches back then. They may have had differences on baptism, the Lord's Supper, church government, but if you ask them how to be saved, they would all basically say the same thing. Young Bible scholars trained in Europe brought modernism with them when they returned home. And this is a really awful and sad thing. Modernism denies the supernatural, the blood atonement, the deity and resurrection of Christ, the inerrancy of the Bible. Okay? So this started infiltrating schools in America who trained preachers, and then the preachers brought the teaching into the churches and took the churches down. And the first half of the 20th century, the battle would be between modernism and fundamentalism. Fundamentalism was simply a defense of historic Christianity. And I'm going to stop with the slides there. One more quick anecdote. We talked about missions in the 19th century. There was a Baptist missionary that went to a place called Ongoli in India. He had a background in engineering, and the British government asked him to work on a water project, which he did. He oversaw this water project, and he was evangelizing while he was digging. They had scads and scads of Indian employees, and as the project came to an end, there were over 2,000 of them that requested baptism. And he came to the conclusion these people just are hoping, they've had jobs and they want to continue. They want to still have jobs when this is all over with. Well, I can't do anything about their jobs. I'm working for the British government. And once the project's over, it's over. There aren't going to be any jobs. So he advised the Indian pastors, let's wait. Let's carefully examine each one of them before we baptize any of them. So they waited. It was obvious there weren't going to be any more jobs, and not as many people were actually baptized as requested. You know, the first count was 2,200. It was actually like 2,180 that were actually baptized, all on one day. So that was an exciting thing in missionary history. I've got to stop. We'll start up here next time.